Good day and welcome to Letters in Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. Last night, President Donald Trump, in addressing a crowd in Tennessee, called the Democratic candidate in that state for Senate a tool of Chuck Schumer, Nancy Pelosi, an MS-13 lover, that Democrats are more concerned taking care of criminals than they are so-called regular people. He called Bernie Sanders Crazy Bernie, and he accused the Robert Mueller investigation of meddling in the 2018 midterm election, which is a pretty serious charge. He said all of this while whipping up a large crowd into a frenzy, as you may have heard in our headlines. Now, some will look at this and argue it's another sign of creeping fascism, and perhaps it is. It doesn't mean that we necessarily live in a fascist state, but I think many people would agree that Donald Trump has exhibited some fascist tendencies. Now, there are many out there who are surprised by all of this, that we could talk about fascism and this country in the same paragraph, if not the same sentence, if not side by side. But it may not be all that surprising if you think of history. It may not be that surprising that a country built on settler colonialism, genocide, and chattel slavery would also drift into fascism. Now, I wish that last statement was my own, but it's not. I'm quoting today's guest, Gerald Horn, who is a professor of African-American history at the University of Houston. Gerald Horn recently stopped by our radio station where we had a good discussion. We talked about current politics, we talked about fascism, and we talked about history, including about his latest book, which is called The Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, and Capitalism in 17th Century North America and the Caribbean. This book is a prequel to a previous book that we've had him on before called The Counter-Revolution of 1776, in which Professor Horn argues that the American Revolution for Independence was a war in order to protect slavery. Now, here is our conversation with Gerald Horn. Gerald Horn, it is a good pleasure to welcome you back to KPFA. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
It's good to see you. This is, I guess we would call your latest work, what we call it, a prequel.
Yes.
To another book that we've had you on that a lot of our listeners were really excited about when we talked to you about a previous book called The Counter-Revolution of 1776. And let's just summarize that, that argument quickly before we dive into what your further argument here. And if I recall correctly, what you were arguing, the reason you call it the Counter-Revolution of 1776 is you're saying that the American, and you have said that the American Revolution has always been about protecting slavery in North America, as well as allowing the class of Americans to be able to control slavery.
Yeah, the 1776 book suggests that the revolt against British rule in the 1770s was driven, number one, in reaction to Somerset's case in June 1772 in England, which actually suggested that slavery would be abolished in England, and seemed to suggest that that decision would leapfrog the Atlantic and thereby jeopardize fortunes in the colonies, not least North America and the Caribbean. Secondly, that book suggests that the revolt against British rule was driven by the so-called Royal Proclamation of 1763, whereby London expressed displeasure at continually moving west across North America, coming into conflict with the indigenous populations, expending tremendous amounts of blood and treasure so that real estate speculators like George Washington, real estate speculator number one, could profit. And the settlers, led by Washington, reacted strongly to that and kicked out London. And by your fruits you shall know them. And it's very striking that this so-called progressive step forward for humanity, embodied allegedly in 1776, led to United States rather quickly supplanting London as captain of the African slave trade. That is to say that by the 1790s, the U.S. nationals were leading the African slave trade to Cuba. By the 1840s, they had captured a good deal of the market, and the largest market, which was Brazil. And, of course, they kept moving west, as we all know. And that, of course, helps to suggest why the United States is this continental power. I think also that that book, it tries to make a reflection upon the present, as I think history should seek to do. I mean, that's not necessarily a one-to-one relationship, but at the same time, I think it's folly to write about the past and suggest it has no connection to the present. What I mean is that if you look at the United States before the Civil War, what I'm suggesting, not only in that 1776 book, but some other books that I've written, is that with regard to Euro-American opinion, you basically have three factions. You have a faction embodied by John Brown, the great abolitionist who tried to lead an armed uprising against slavery, and was executed in 1859. But it would be a mistake to suggest that John Brown represented majority sentiment. He was a distinct minority.
Right.
Secondly, you have the pro-slavery sentiment as embodied in George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, the lawyer for slave owners, speaking of John Adams, the largest slave owner in Boston, speaking of John Hancock. And they, of course, are then followed by Jefferson Davis, who, on behalf of the so-called Confederate States of America, seeks to overthrow the United States government because the United States had come under such tremendous international pressure to move away from slavery.
That's an interesting linkage of the Civil War to the Revolutionary War.
Well, of course, yes. And then there's the third faction, which sometimes the historians rather deceptively call an anti-slavery faction. They were against slavery, but they were against slavery because they thought the United States should be a so-called white man's country. And therefore, when Oregon enters the Union in the 1850s, there are no Negroes allowed, even to the point now, and Portland has probably the smallest black population of any of the major cities, a direct descendant of that particular fateful decision in the 1850s.
Now, are these people that are supporting the colonization to move
to
Liberia?
Negroes should move.
Yeah.
They should move to Liberia. They should be, or even Lincoln for a good deal of his career, they should be freed and then ousted. Now, during the U.S. Civil War, the United States government under Lincoln, in many ways, they were losing until the Emancipation Proclamation, which then frees the enslaved in territory controlled by the so-called Confederate States of America, which leads to a massive influx of black men to join the Union, and that turns the tide. And then that begins to influence Lincoln with regard to his previous white man's country ideas, and then he's murdered. And then, of course, Jim Crow laws follow the murder of Lincoln and Reconstruction and the overthrow of Reconstruction circa 1877. And if you fast forward to the present, if you look at all these very curious episodes, such as the Starbucks episode in Philadelphia, where the black men are asked to move or arrested, actually, or the recent Airbnb case in Rialto, California, where Bob Marley's granddaughter is the police are called up on her because she was in she had rented a house there, and the neighbors were nervous because she had violated a white space. It led to a confrontation with the police. A Yale graduate student, this is all in the last few days, had fallen asleep studying, writing papers, and she was perceived as violating a white space. And so what happens is that the white man's country faction is still alive and well. And I think that it's very difficult for those with a rosy idea about the United States to come to that very difficult conclusion that even the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which was supposed to guarantee the entry of black people and people of color into these previously all-white spaces, that it can be nullified on the ground, as these incidents suggest. And so that, in sum, is my analysis of 1776 going forward to 2018.
And yet, in your new book, you take a step backwards into the previous century.
Yes.
Now we're talking about the 1600s.
That's right.
In which you focus on the 1600s in the book, The Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism. And you focus on the development of this idea and notion and identity of whiteness. And I guess
yes.
Whiteness counter to Africans, slaves, I guess, here.
Yes.
And native people.
Yes. Well, I call it militarized identity politics. That is to say, how was it that those who had been warring on the shores of Europe, English versus Irish, English versus Scots, English versus Welsh, British versus French, British versus German, German versus Russian, Russian versus Pole, Serb versus Croat, Greek versus Macedonian, Northern Italian versus Southern Italian, even to a certain degree, Christian versus Jewish, Christian versus Protestant, Catholic versus Protestant, How is it that magically, once they cross the Atlantic, they assume this new identity known as whiteness, a stubborn identity politics that has persisted through 2018? And the argument I put forward is that this was a response to colonialism. This was a response to the need and desire for the settlers to overawe and overcome the indigenous population in the first place. And then as they are subjected to ethnic cleansing, that is to say, moved out of the land that they once controlled, oftentimes sold into the slave markets of the Ottoman Turks or even as far away as Madagascar. I mean, you can find indigenous American DNA scattered all over the world, of course, sold into slavery in the Caribbean. And this identity politics then it rules. It winds up triumphing. Now, of course, it's not without difficulty because, of course, there are battles with regard to control of the subcontinent. But in any case, to back up for a second from this militarized identity politics, the book starts in the early 1600s and asks the question, how was it that England, this minor power on the fringes of Europe, a second-rate power at best, with Spain, Portugal, the Ottoman Turks, even the Dutch to a certain degree being the ascendant powers, how was it that by the end of the 1600s, it's a major power, well on its way to superpower status and the creation of this mighty British Empire, and that even the blow inflicted by George Washington and his comrades does not shake that status that persists until the 20th century. And the short answer to that transformation, that momentous transformation, is slavery and the slave trade. That is to say that England entered into this lucrative market. And what's interesting, as I said before we went on air, I'm doing this book about the 1500s now. Yeah. And what's striking about the 1500s with regard to England is that not only is it a minor power, but it's working with the North Africans in particular as against their antagonist that is Spain. This is reflected, you might recall, in Shakespeare's Othello, which is a very sensitive and humane portrayal of an African. And that reflects London's foreign policy at that particular moment in time. In fact, London was portraying itself as the friend of the Africans, as against the evil Spanish who were enslaving Africans. London doesn't become a major player in the African slave trade until the 1600s. So in the 1500s, they're portraying themselves as a friend of Africa. In fact, when the Moroccans, in a very momentous victory, defeat the Iberians, the Spain and Portuguese force in the latter part of the 1500s, it's largely because of arms supplied by London. And so this is London in the late 1500s going into the 1600s. And so what happens is that with this fateful decision to enter into the African slave trade, which is in some ways it's sort of accidental in the sense that they found themselves in need of a labor supply. They found themselves in a mighty conflict with the indigenous population who they initially wanted to enslave. But that proved to be rather difficult because it's very difficult to move into a neighborhood and start enslaving your neighbors and expect them not to revolt and react. And so after they were then liquidated or removed, the need arose for a labor supply. And as I tell the story, the turning point comes in the 1650s, in fact, with England inflicting a stupendous blow on its antagonist, speaking of Spain, by ousting the Spanish from Jamaica, 1655. That opens up more territory for settlers. It also helps to contribute to a sugar boom. And as you know, sugar becomes a major crop in the Caribbean for decades following, up and through the 20th century. Sugar is not only an item used to sweeten your coffee and tea, it's seen as a marker of sophistication, not unlike tobacco, once had been seen and now is reviled, and just as sugar is now reviled. And it was also seen in some quarters as a miracle drug. And so with the profits flowing from the sugar boom, London was able to offer more land to the settlers, the poor people, the English and the Irish, who, of course, they were warring with. The English were warring with the Irish and then were deporting them en masse to places like Barbados and Jamaica. And that those that wealth then allows England to build more ships to transport those that sugar to the markets of Europe, and more ships to transport enslaved African labor from West Africa and East Africa to the Caribbean and ultimately to North America. And warships that then allows England to oust the Dutch, the declining power, from Manhattan and what are now the U.S. mid-Atlantic states in 1664, which opens up more land in terms of this a circle devoid of virtue as far as the Africans and the indigenous population is concerned, leading to a replication of that process just enunciated. More ships, which of course requires workers in these towns in England, getting wages, which whereby they can buy more goods, and you see the English economy beginning to boom. And by 1672, you see the Royal African Company form, that is to say, the systematizing of the African slave trade under the thumb of the monarch. 1683, another turning point, the Ottoman Turks are stopped at the gates of Vienna, which relieves pressure on the Western Europeans, because for the longest time, when Western Europeans were sailing southward to Africa to enslave Africans and West Africans, they ran the risk of being enslaved in North Africa by the Ottoman Turks. That lasts, in fact,
up in Barbary states too.
Of course, yeah. Until the 19, you know, from the howls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli, the early United States is also plagued with that same phenomenon. It lasts for quite a long time, but certainly you begin to see the precipitous decline of the Ottoman Turks.
You're right. There's some million slaves.
I mean, there are so-called white slaves.
Yeah.
And in fact, a number of officials who become leaders of the settler colonies in North America have a brush with enslavement in North Africa, which doesn't make them more sensitive to the question of slavery in the least. And then 1688, you have the so-called Glorious Revolution. And as I tell the story, and to be fair, as other historians have told the story too, among other things, the Glorious Revolution is a revolt by the merchant class, which wants in on the lucrative nature of the African slave trade. They clip the wings of the monarch as a result. And so if you back up for a moment, you'll see that I'm making this argument that the so-called Glorious Revolution, 1688 in England, is driven by the African slave trade. 1776, driven by the African slave trade. 1861, driven by the African slave trade. And I would also say 1836, when Texas secedes from Mexico, because Mexico had moved to abolish slavery in the 1820s, driven by the African slave trade. And so, therefore, it should not be seen as accidental that these black people who are the legacy of this African slave trade are still getting it in the neck, still being pulverized. And I think, assuming that we survived the Trump era, one of the questions that I think our descendants will ask was that why couldn't people why were all these incidents, you know, the police killings, Eric Garner in New York, Philando Castile in Minnesota, the quotidian harassment that I described a moment ago of black people, why is it always seen as sort of accidental and coincidental and against our so-called founding ideals? I mean, what were these people smoking that led them to this kind of delusional thinking? And I think what it bespeaks is really the power of propaganda, or as Du Bois called it, propaganda is history.
Let's talk a little more about the so-called Glorious Revolution of 1688. This is the overthrow of King James II.
Well, not so much the overthrow as it is clipping the wings of the monarch and empowering Parliament.
I guess what it becomes like a constitutional monarchy or something. But now you see the emergence and the power of Parliament.
Right.
Through this.
Right.
And that's the popular telling of it. Your telling of it is this is now unregulating the slave trade.
Deregulating the slave trade. I mean, it's one of the most profitable enterprises known to humankind. You can invest $1 and get $1,700 back. And that 1,700% profit unleashed the animal spirits and the magic of the marketplace, to use contemporary lingo. And there are those who would sell their firstborn for a 1,700% profit, not to mention some African that they did not know. But, of course, the fly in the ointment, if you like, is that the Africans did not want to be enslaved. They were involved in rebellions, large and small. That is to say, they're the day-to-day rebellions of grinding up glass and putting it in the food of the slave-owning family, or arson, which was probably the most trusted friend of the enslaved. That is to say, burning down the mansion, burning down the crops, for example. Poisonings. You had a number of Africans, particularly African women, who became what might be called ethnobotanists. They had mastered plants and knew what plants were poisonous and therefore would poison the slave-owning family. Murder, of course. Assault and battery. And so this is the environment under which this country was built. And so it's no accident that after the settlers overthrow London, they moved to have a Second Amendment to the Constitution, and these militias, that is to say, that an armed populace that could be called into action to suppress the revolts of the enslaved or suppress the revolts of the indigenous population whose land was being taken from them. And then that has been bequeathed to us today in terms of these, what some of us consider to be these insane laws concerning armaments that leads to school killings in southern Florida and assaults on churches in Texas and all of the rest. I mean, this is what I mean with regard to how it can be folly to ignore history when trying to comprehend and understand the present.
And it's said that history is always about the present.
Well,
when you're either writing or talking about it. I mean, of course, it's about trying to get the record straight,
mm-hmm.
but in telling it, it's always about our present.
Well, yes. And one of the things I find intriguing nowadays, if I can talk about the present for a moment,
please,
is that, you know, you have this very intriguing trend right now of these elite elements warning about fascism in the United States and the world. Madeleine Albright, former U.S. Secretary of State, fascism a warning. You'll find it in all the bookstores. Cass Sunstein, the spouse of former Obama United Nations Ambassador Samantha Power and a Harvard Law professor himself, has this new collection, Can It Happen Here? A play on that book from the 1930s.
Upton Sinclair?
Was it Upton Sinclair or Sinclair?
Or Sinclair Lewis.
Yeah.
Sinclair Lewis.
Right.
I get it mixed
right
up sometimes.
And then Timothy Snyder of Yale, The Road to Unfreedom. And Michael Kinsley, the former editor of The New Republic, who happens to be an heir to the Microsoft fortune through marriage. He was one of the first people to ring the alarm about Trump as fascist. But what's interesting about this, a couple things are interesting. One is that these analysts and historians do not draw a link between having a country built on fascism and built on slavery and apartheid tipping into fascism. I mean, that doesn't enter into their equation. Secondly, a country that can support and help to engineer fascist coups in Chile in September 11, 1973, and support apartheid South Africa, and have a form, and according to Stephen F. Cohen, emeritus professor at Princeton and NYU, a foreign policy that today is supporting fascist battalions in Ukraine, according to Stephen F. Cohen, that doesn't enter into their equation either. But perhaps even more disturbing is that these are all elite elements warning about fascism. Although, as I said, their arguments leave something to be desired, but at least they sense something in the air. I don't necessarily see that coming from our friends on the left. That is to say, when you talk to our friends on the left about Trump, they're always diminishing the November 2016 triumph, that X number of voters voted for Obama in 2008 and 2012, and then they voted for Trump in 2016. The median or average, depending on who's talking, income is $72,000 a year of Trump voters. That doesn't sound... You know, it sounds like wealthy people to me, even though you have teachers and minors, et cetera, and cops who make $72,000 a year. So they're always trying to diminish the, there's a tendency to diminish what we're facing, whereas the elite are sounding the alarm. And I have to say, I think even with their weak rationales, I think the elite have the better of that argument. That is to say that I think what the elite should do is come to the honest and painful recognition that a country that was based upon massive dispossession of indigenous populations and then mass enslavement of Africans, well, of course, that creates a fertile womb for fascist trends. And I know that's a very difficult realization for people to arrive at, but Mr. Trump is not leaving us with that many alternatives.
We are in conversation with Gerald Horn. He is a professor of history at the University of Houston, author of some 36 books. His latest is called The Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, and Capitalism in 17th Century North America and the Caribbean. So that's interesting. You're saying these elites, the people that you mentioned, including Madeleine Albright, Timothy Snyder is somebody we've had on this program. He wrote the book Tyranny, very short book. They're missing the larger analysis of you know, as you mentioned, a nation built on slavery, on genocide. The fact that it could drift towards fascism isn't so surprising.
Not in the least.
To where they portray it and as oh my goodness, something amiss. But at the same time, they're not wrong in saying that there's something to be concerned about.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you could even make an argument that the way that people of color, particularly black people and indigenous people, have been treated historically was in a fascist-like manner, which was linked, as many of the founders and the early antebellum leaders in the United States recognized, that helped to create a certain freedom, if you like, in quotes, for those not viewed as people of color. Now, I think that some of our friends on the left, they have problems with that argument because, understandably, their argument is, you know, black and white unite and fight. And then if you start talking about the interests of these communities being juxtaposed or being at odds, it complicates the notion of them uniting in 2018. And I understand that. But history is a harsh teacher. Yeah. And we haven't done too well with these arguments that sweep that conflict under the rug. I mean, we're talking about being the cusp of fascism. So obviously we haven't done that well. So perhaps it's time to take a new stance.
I want to get into more of this idea of whiteness because it's relatively new. I mean, several hundred years, if that could be new. But it was very different before. And it's very much connected to the transatlantic slave trade.
Well, you know, yeah, I mean,
we've had slavery. Let me ask this: we've had slavery for a very long time.
Yes.
It goes back thousands of years.
Yes.
But it fundamentally changes
right
in the 1500s.
Yeah, well, slavery is a mode of production, not unlike feudalism or capitalism. Oftentimes, it was based upon what to do with prisoners of war once they were snatched. But the slavery, for example, that deposited my ancestors in North America and for those who don't have a Facebook live streaming, I'm a black person. that was a different kind of slavery because it was based on a certain kind of racialization and these doctrines of white supremacy. And then it was yoked to this roaring engine, this roaring locomotive of capitalism. And that gives it a special nature and a special character. Now, it's interesting, in my 1776 book, quoting secondary sources, I posit that whiteness as a concept arises in the 1600s. In that book, the book that's now before us, The Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism, I suggest that whiteness arises in the 1500s, post-Columbus, the early encounters of the indigenous population in the Americas. Now that I'm doing a book on the 1500s, I keep running into what we know to be true, which is that Israel, even before Columbus in the 1440s, you had the Iberians, the Portuguese in particular, enslaving Africans in Portugal itself. And we also know that these projects, I mean, if you look at Columbus, I mean, it's sort of an example. I mean, here you have a man who we would say is of Italian origin, who is being employed by what, who we would say are Spanish monarchs. And then you have, so you have the seeds of whiteness in, embodied and embedded, even before, Columbus begins to sail. That is to say, so, I don't rule out the possibility that we can find the seeds of whiteness before the 1500s, perhaps in the 14th. And then after I finish the 1500s book and do the 14th, I might be able to find it.
You might trace it on the way back to the classical world.
Right. Who knows?
Possible.
I'm trying to keep an open mind. Let's put it that way, but not an empty mind.
But where we are now, where you are now, though, again, how slavery changed in the 1500s. And this is led by Portugal and Spain.
That's right. Well, yeah, I mean, and of course, I'm sure many of your listeners know the story about the enslavement of the indigenous populations of the Americas and how the Spanish intellectual Las Casas rails against that. And then that helps to fuel the enslavement of more Africans, which, as I said, had been taking place as early as the 1400s in any case. And as I tell the story, what happens is that the Iberians, because by about 1580, you have a consolidation of Spain and Portugal under one monarch. So the Iberians are parasites. I mean, they're looting the Aztecs of today's Mexico and the Incas in particular of today's Peru. And then the English are parasites on the parasites because Sir Francis Drake, who I've been looking into during my visit to the Bay Area because Queen Elizabeth's pirate, as he was called, in June 1579, within hailing distance of where we're now sitting, had claimed this part of North America for London. He called it Nova Albion. And in fact, there are certain scholars who suggest that this territory, at least in a putative sense, was the first portion of the nascent British Empire, Northern California of all places.
Nova Albion, what does that mean? New?
New England.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, you know, he doesn't just call it New England the way
they did. They called New England.
Right. And of course, you know, this territory was claimed, well, it was native indigenous territory, then claimed by Spain. But then Sir Francis Drake, the parasite, is claiming it for London. And of course, Sir Francis Drake and these other pirates or privateers, as they're called in a euphemistic sense, are authorized by Queen Elizabeth to plunder the Spanish ships groaning with silver as they're sailing eastward to Spain, perhaps making a stop in Havana. And this helps create what might be called a primitive accumulation of capital for a growing England so that by the early 1600s, it can send its own settlers to what is now Virginia. And then, as we know, by 1619, began this historic process of enslavement of Africans. But in some ways, it's all based upon preying upon the Spanish Empire. And I should also say, supporting the Dutch, who were in contestation with the Spanish, and supporting the Dutch in their fight with the Spanish, which in some ways was fattening the sheep for slaughter, is the term that I use, because as the Dutch and the Spanish are fighting each other, this also allows London to rise. And then after in 1650, it might have been suspected that a black person like myself sitting in North America in 2018 would be speaking Dutch instead of English. Because the Dutch in 1650 were seen as the rising power. And then right. In 1652, of course, they had settled, quote-unquote, South Africa, what is now Cape Town. But of course, that was a false dawn because, as noted, by 1664, the knockout blow was administered by rising London as they are profiting from the sugar boom.
Is this a tulip bubble? I don't know. I might have my times
later.
Mixed up here. Is that later
in the
tulip bubbles? Yeah. Okay. One of the first major bubbles of mm-hmm. capitalism.
It might be heartening to the United States, pardon my sarcasm, to recognize that it sometimes takes a while for these empires to decline. And then, once again, the Dutch should be something of an example. You know, the Netherlands has been declining for about 300 years. But Amsterdam is still, for some, a very pleasant place to live. So people should not necessarily be disheartened by the decline of the U.S. empire.
Well, I thought if we were to go down the road of Europe mm-hmm. and have universal health care.
Oh, I see.
And, a transit system that's pretty efficient.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm not saying they have ended their foreign adventures, but I'm mm-hmm. just saying, you know, I could foresee worse outcomes for America.
Oh, sure. And of course, as we sit here and as we speak, I think one of the issues we should all be concerned about is this growing rift between the European Union and the United States. It's not only the fact that Mr. Trump may be slapping sanctions on steel and aluminum from the European Union in a few days. It's not only this decision on Iran, which is jeopardizing investments by Airbus, the competitor to Boeing in Iran, and Total, the French oil company, and Royal Dutch Shell in Iran. It's also the climate change decision, which President Macron came to Washington a few days ago specifically to try to seek a reversal on that particular issue. So it seems to me the Europeans have a choice to make. And once again, I have a personal anecdote. Some months ago, the German Historical Institute, which is a Berlin-based entity close to the German government, headquartered in Washington, D.C., right off DuPont Circle, invited me and a number of other black scholars to come speak. You know, it's part, you know, just like the United States is trying to influence people in Germany, Germany is trying to influence people in the United States. So I said, sure, even though they didn't pay me. But I said, sure.
Pay for your trip?
They didn't pay for my trip.
Hmm.
Which makes even more ironic what I'm about to say. Because once I get there, you know, I thought, because you could already see signs of this growing transatlantic rift. So I say, okay, you know, Berlin wants to try to work out a deal with the Negroes, you know. But instead, they're trying to push me to the right. I mean, basically. And push me off sort of anti-imperialist and radical ideas. And I was saying, these people are not following the news. I mean, you know, this whole foreign ministry needs to be fired. I mean, they should be trying to woo me as opposed to trying to turn me to the right until another propagandist for Uncle Sam.
That's how it used to be done, right?
Well, what do you mean?
Foreign powers that were trying to have influence in the United States, maybe the Soviet Union would be an example, have always tried to woo black people here.
Of course. Yeah. Of course. And actually, that's been one of the themes of this book, because, as I said, in the 1500s, London was portraying itself as the friend of the Negroes.
Yeah.
And in fact, if you look at Sir Francis Drake's successes, for example, in Panama, during the same time period that I was just discussing, he's cutting deals with the Africans against the interests of the Spanish, the Cimarrones, or the Maroons, who are in some ways are the majority of the population. And then after England gets a foothold in the African slave trade, then the Spanish try to woo the Africans under the Union Jack. If you look at Stono's Rebellion in 1739 in South Carolina, for example, that's basically a joint project by the Spanish who were then occupying Florida and the enslaved Africans under the Union Jack in South Carolina. And then after the overthrow of British rule, with, of course, the black people fighting by several orders of magnitude under the Union Jack against George Washington and company, which is one of the reasons why we're still having it such difficulty here in North America, because when you fight a war and lose, you should be expected to be punished and pulverized for an indefinite period, unless and until you can turn the tables. And so then we allied with the British against the Yankees. And, of course, in the War of 1812, we helped to sack and plunder Washington, D.C., sending James Madison and his garrulous spouse, Dolly, fleeing into the streets one step ahead of the posse. And that was during a time when Britain was in a de facto alliance with the Haitian revolutionaries, who had triumphed 1791 to 1804, which, as I tell the story, is the beginning and the end for slavery and ignites a general crisis of the entire slave system that could only be resolved with its collapse. And then you mention the Soviet Union in the 20th century. You could mention the Mexican revolutionaries in the 20th century. We were just talking about Jack Johnson, the black heavyweight champion in the early part of the 20th century, roots in Galveston, who President Trump has talked about pardoning. Although, during the Mexican Revolutionary period, 1910 to 1920, he had basically established a base in Mexico to fight the United States, which is, I think, one of the reasons why his pardon is going to be complicated. And then another book that I published...
The charge against Jack Johnson?
Charges against Jack Johnson have to do with violating of the Mann Act. That's what sent him into exile. That is to say, so-called White Slavery Act. That is to say, he was consorting with Euro-American women, and that was a faux pas that led to his prosecution. And rather than go to jail, he fled. Wound up in Mexico, and then as Mexico goes through turmoil, he comes back. That's talked about in my book, Black and Brown, African Americans and the Mexican Revolution, and then is jailed. And that's what's subject to the pardon, not necessarily those political activities.
Yeah.
But I was about to mention this other book that I published just a few weeks ago, Facing the Rising Sun, African Americans, Japan, and the Rise of Afro-Asian Solidarity. It talks about this remarkable alliance between black people in Tokyo in the period leading up to Pearl Harbor. Where in November 1942 in East St. Louis, Illinois, you have these black people in uniform and armed, engaged in military drills, anticipating an invasion of North America by Japan that they were going to join on behalf of Imperial Tokyo. Now, this is many of the predecessors of the black nationalists, including those who came to prominence in the organization we now know as the Nation of Islam, for example, and the Moore Science Temple, for example. So this whole idea that I've just sketched in a few seconds of black people allying with the antagonists of the United States, I thought that that's what was going to happen when Berlin, the German Historical Institute, invited me to come speak. But I guess they haven't consulted the history, and they were out of tune.
Gerald Horn, in our few remaining minutes together, I want to ask you a little bit more about today, because I always have found your analysis, especially of the left and us, to be important. And you mentioned that there's this interesting dynamic right now with the elite, people like Madeleine Albright. I mean, I mean, we were talking a lot about fascism, too. As soon as I saw Madeleine Albright publish a book, I'm like, maybe gave me pause, you know.
Right.
But at the same time, you know, the left is very divided, I think, over the issue of right now in Trump.
Oh, absolutely.
And over Russia. Mm-hmm. How do you see everything that's
well,
happening?
Well, yeah. Well, you know, I think assuming we survive the 45th president, I think one of the things that we found captivating by future historians is that the analysis of Moscow should have been along these lines. How was it that many had thought that once communists were ousted, circa 1991, that was the issue? And that a new rosy dawn of fruitful Washington-Moscow bilateral relations would ensue. Apparently, that has not happened. And so it seems to me, as an historical analyst, that should lead you to another kind of analysis, which is, what are some of the underlying fault lines that help to shed light on why that rosy dawn did not ensue? I think it's too subjective just to put it all at the doorstep of Vladimir Putin. I think that's a very subjective kind of analysis. I think that with regard to the 2016 election, I think that it's heartening that the U.S. authorities are following the money with regard to the funding of Michael Cohen, the president's fixer, and perhaps the funding of the Trump real estate empire, particularly during the period when he was having difficulty as the king of debt getting loans, and how Donald Jr. says that they're getting a lot of money from Russia. But I find it ironic that those who were in league with the United States, for example, Michael Cohen's father-in-law, who was a leading corrupt figure in terms of Ukrainian politics, or the relative of Chrystia Freeland, the equivalent of the foreign minister of Canada, who was also of Ukrainian descent, that those people who had been collaborating with Washington against communist rule now are being targeted and pointed to as being part of the problem. I think that ultimately future historians may conclude that in any case, there was an overdetermination of the role of Moscow, not only with regard to the 2016 elections, which I think we would be better served by looking at voter suppression, but also because the overdetermination of Moscow then led to the fateful decision to have an alliance with China under Nixon, which led to massive direct foreign investment in China, where the United States thought that forevermore China would be satisfied with being a source of cheap labor. But now it's turned the tables and by 2025 wants to lead in artificial energy, quantum computing, autonomous vehicles, and all of the rest. And apparently is in the passing lane. So I think that future historians might easily conclude that there has been this massive overdetermination of Moscow, which is at odds with, say, John McCain saying that it's Russia is a filling station masquerading as a nation, basically lampooning its role as an oil and natural gas supplier. But if that's the case, and Barack Obama also making disparaging comments about Russia, well, then why is there all this excessive focus on this filling station masquerading as a great nation? I think that the U.S.-Russia, the line on Russia in the United States is a snarl of contradictions. And I'm afraid to say that the left has not been very helpful in helping to unpack these contradictions.
How would you unpack them?
Well,
in 3 minutes.
Well, I would say look at the underlying fault lines, as I was trying to suggest. I would try to suggest that historically, I just wrote a review for this academic journal where I doubt if it'll be published because I questioned what is considered to be this great victory. That is to say, Nixon's trip to China. And as I just said, I think that that really was, it reminds me, the parallel that I draw is that in the early part of the 1900s, London appoints Tokyo as its watchdog in Asia. And in part, this is because of a fear of Moscow, particularly from its perch in Vladivostok, which, of course, is not that far from what is now North Korea. But obviously, that boomeranged by December 8, 1941, when Japanese troops basically ousted British troops from Singapore and Malaya and Hong Kong and all the rest, or even going back to the so-called Crimean War of the 1850s, where Britain is at war with Russia because of this fear of the Russians moving southward to challenge the British Empire and what is now India. So I think we need a deeper examination of why these empires keep overdetermining Russia. And then it winding up in disaster as the British Empire suffered in December 8, 1941, and as the United States might be suffering in the 21st century.
Yeah, I guess my take on it has been, okay, Russia may have tried to play a very minor role in the election. That's what world powers do. I shouldn't be surprised about that. I can't think that on top of everything else, it's certainly not the most important issue that came down to determining who the next president would be. Yet I find it absolutely bizarre how this administration's responding to the investigation. That to me has almost become the story itself.
Well, I think it's the money angle.
Yeah.
That I think that there's an illicit nature of the Trump real estate empire with Russia in terms of laundering billions purloined from the former Soviet Union through buying condos in South Florida, for example, and a fear of having that exposed and revealed. So I think that helps to undergird and explain why the Trump team has been almost clinically paranoid with regard to any sort of talk about Russia, even though if you look at their policy in Ukraine hasn't been that different from the Obama policy in Ukraine. And likewise, the Trump policy was the idea of a reset with Moscow and a pivot towards China. And that was the Obama policy that then ran aground after 2014 with the episodes in the Ukraine. So that's been a remarkable continuity from Obama to Trump that I think some commentators have missed.
So it seems like a self-fulfilling prophecy to me when Trump starts and Republicans start talking about impeachment. It seems like it's almost inevitable that at least some type of proceedings could occur.
Well, I think it depends on who takes the House.
I mean, it's all about the election.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And right now, as we speak, it doesn't look like the Democrats will take the Senate, and they would be the body that would have to remove him.
Right. But you can have an impeachment in the House still.
Yes, you can have an indictment, but in terms of removal, it would take the Senate. And then you have senators like Joe Manchin of West Virginia, who was going to apparently vote for Bloody Gina to be CIA director.
Even when John McCain says he would not, and urged others not to.
Well, God, I mean, it's just like the campaign of Don Blankenship, the criminal mine operator who kept talking about China persons, China people, and trying to cast aspersions on Mitch McConnell because he's married to a Chinese-American woman. I mean, I thought that he thought that he could do a Trump. He said he was Trumpier than Trump. That is to say, he used racism as a launching pad at the higher office. Apparently, it didn't work. But I doubt if that will forestall others trying to go down that road.
Also called Mitch McConnell Cocaine Mitch.
Right.
I like that. As another Mitch. I kind of added a nice ring to it.
Oh, I see.
Gerald Horn, good to see you. Thank you.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Again, Gerald Horn has been our guest, professor of history at the University of Houston, author of a number of books, the latest, The Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, and Capitalism in 17th Century North America and the Caribbean. And that does it for Letters and Politics. The show is produced by Deanna Martinez. Kristen Thomas is our engineer. You can find archives of our previous shows online at kpfa.org. I'm Mitch Jezerich, and I thank you for listening.
This is Ryan Edwards Tegart, and I just wanted to thank everybody who pledged during our Spring Fund Drive. You're amazing. And also let those of you who did not pledge know that for a very limited time, you can still get all of our thank you gifts from the Spring Fund Drive when you pledge online at kpfa.org. We're about 1 year into an effort to shrink the amount of time we spend fundraising to free up more time for regular coverage here at KPFA because there is a lot happening in the world. That's meant when our fund drives are raising more than we expect that we end the fund drives early instead of pocketing the extra. It means when the fund drives are coming up short, like this last one did, we stick to our guns and we end on time and try to sort it out afterwards. And if you appreciate that, and if you appreciate the coverage you get every day here at KPFA,